This is the first in a two-part series that aims to introduce you to the work of Dr. Rainier de Blois and honor some of the incredible labor of love that he has poured out for the sake of the Bible translation community and movement. Specifically, I want to highlight his work in Hebrew lexicography as he nears the end of a project that has spanned over two decades, and that is the creation of a new semantic dictionary of biblical Hebrew, which is available under an open Creative Commons license. This can be found over at semanticdictionary.org. Back in 2000, he wrote a paper outlining some of his vision for the new dictionary, and I think it would be valuable for us to work through some of it together. I'm Andrew Case, and you're listening to Working for the Word. Now, before we dive into his paper, allow me to introduce you briefly to Dr. Rainier de Blois. He's from the Netherlands and is currently the coordinator of ICAP for the United Bible Societies. ICAP stands for the Institute for Computer Assisted Publishing, which is a global initiative of the United Bible Societies which provides technology support and training for the scripture translation and publishing community. The ICAP team has extensive experience in text archiving and data conversion and a long history of working closely with national Bible societies and partner agencies. The knowledge and expertise accrued in this area serves as a foundation for the ongoing development of the Digital Bible Library. So currently, he is in charge of the development of Bible publishing software, including implementation and training. Dr. de Blois is also a translation consultant and has served on projects in Nigeria, Guinea, and Tanzania. He teaches at Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary in Grand Rapids as well, and has published a number of things that you can see listed on his CV over at academia.edu. Now, before we get into his paper entitled Towards a New Dictionary of Biblical Hebrew Based on Semantic Domains, let me define a few key terms from his paper for those who may be unfamiliar with those terms. First, a gloss. A gloss is a brief notation, especially a marginal or interlinear one, of the meaning of a word or wording in a text. Second, semantics. Semantics is the study of linguistic meaning. It examines what meaning is, how words get their meaning, and how the meaning of a complex expression depends on its parts. Part of this process involves the distinction between sense and reference. Sense is given by the ideas and concepts associated with an expression, while reference is the object to which an expression points. Semantics contrasts with syntax, which studies the rules that dictate how to create grammatically correct sentences, and pragmatics, which investigates how people use language and communication. And lexical semantics is the branch of semantics that studies word meaning. So with that, let's dive into some selections from his paper. The major weakness of many of the traditional Hebrew dictionaries lies in the fact that instead of giving the meaning of a particular Hebrew word, usually not more than one or more glosses of that word in the target language are given. This actually does not apply to Hebrew dictionaries only, but to many traditional dictionaries of other languages as well. This is a pity because a set of glosses only gives a limited insight into the meaning of a particular word. Glosses, according to Barr, are not themselves meanings, nor do they tell us the meanings. The meanings reside in the actual Hebrew usage, and for real semantic analysis, the glosses have no greater value than that of indicators or labels for a meaning which resides in the Hebrew itself. The use of glosses can even be misleading. If a certain entry in a particular dictionary is listed with three glosses, the average reader may get the impression that the entry has three meanings, even though those three glosses may be practically synonyms of each other. If we want to know the meaning of a word, we need much more information than can be contained in a simple gloss. It is interesting to note that a number of monolingual dictionaries handle their entries in a much better way. This type of dictionary usually explains the meaning of each word by means of a definition. A good example of such a dictionary is the Concise Oxford Dictionary. Many people, however, seem to think that the only reason why dictionaries of this category make use of definitions rather than glosses lies in the fact that these are monolingual dictionaries and certain words simply do not have the synonyms that could function as glosses. But according to Veers Bicca, when it comes to concepts encoded in words of a foreign language, especially a culturally distant one, the intuitive link between a word and a concept is missing, and a full definition is the only way of ensuring true understanding of the cultural universe encoded in the language's lexicon. Now, before we can write a definition for a particular entry, we have to establish the methodology that is to be followed in order to do this well. The meaning of a word is not automatically equivalent to a long description with a large quantity of encyclopedic information, which, according to Lau, does not explain the meaning of the word, but elaborates on the concept or the object involved. As Nida correctly observes, words have meaning only in terms of systematic contrasts with other words which share certain features with them, but contrast with them in respect to other features. In other words, each particular word is a member of a larger group of words that have certain aspects of meaning in common. Such a group can be called a semantic field or a semantic domain. The meaning of a word can then only be fully understood when we study it in combination with other words that belong to the same semantic domain. This means that before we can write a dictionary of a particular language, we need to start with a set of semantic domains. The next question that comes to mind then is the following: from where do we get those semantic domains? Is there a universal set of semantic domains that can be applied to every individual language? Unfortunately, things are not as simple as that. If the meaning of a word were only a relation to a particular entity in the practical world, we would probably be able to come up with a universal set of domains. This is not the case, however. As Nida observes, the meaning of a word relates to a concept or a set of concepts that people have about an entity or a set of entities in the world around them. And these concepts may vary from one language or culture to another. For that reason, each individual language requires a thorough and structural semantic study before we can even make the slightest effort towards producing a dictionary in that language. This becomes very crucial for translators in cases where there are significant differences in culture and worldview between the source and target language. A Hebrew-English dictionary is such a case, even more so because of the fact that the text of the Hebrew Old Testament with its corresponding worldview is more than 2,000 years old. Now let's discuss the existing Hebrew dictionaries. A classic Hebrew dictionary is the one by Gesenius, of which the first edition was published around 1810, and which was written in the German language. Even long after his death, in 1842, many revisions, translations, and reprints of this classic work appeared. This dictionary contains a treasure of information, including cognates from related languages and references to other scholarly publications, but cannot be considered fully up-to-date anymore. Another well-known dictionary is the one by Brown, Driver, and Briggs, of which the first part was published in 1891 and completed in 1906. Their work was written in English and based on Robinson's translation into English of Gesenius' dictionary, which came out in 1854. The editorial team incorporated many of the discoveries in the fields of archaeology and philology that had been made in the second half of the 19th century in their lexicon, although later editions of Gesenius's dictionary contain much of that information as well. This dictionary has been organized in a slightly different way in that all roots have been listed alphabetically, whereas all entries that are to be considered derivations from those roots have been listed under the roots from which they have been derived. The advantage of this method is that it is easy for the user to see the semantic relationship between each root and its derivatives. This is important because there are many cases where there is no significant difference between the meaning of a root and some of the words that were derived from it. However, this method has some disadvantages and dangers as well. The disadvantage lies in the fact that in a dictionary like this, it is not always easy to find a particular entry if it is not a root. In the case of some of the more irregular verbs, it takes a lot of insight to figure out from which root a particular entry could have been derived. Sometimes more than one single root can be postulated, and what is worse, there can be a lot of differences in opinion as to which root underlies which derivative. Another danger lies in the fact that some users may be inclined to overemphasize the semantic relationship between a particular root and its derivatives. In order to be able to understand the meaning of a word, we will have to study it within its context. And though the etymological aspects of a particular word are not to be neglected, a number of derivatives undergo a certain amount of semantic shift, which only the context in which they occur can help us discover. In spite of these points of criticism, however, BDB should be considered a very valuable tool for both students and scholars, which, even though almost a century has passed since it was first published, is still very useful. As Muraoka puts it, BDB and the 17th edition of Gesenius are still very much alive. As we have seen, however, lexicographical insights have changed significantly over the years, and we need to see those insights applied to Biblical Hebrew as well. Now, about half a century after the publication of BDB, Ludwig Kuller and Walter Baumgartner published the first edition of their lexicon. Kuller was responsible for the Hebrew part, whereas Baumgartner provided the Aramaic part. This edition was bilingual in that it provided glosses in both German and English. 2 years after the death of Kuller, in 1958, a second edition appeared. This actually was an unaltered reprint of the first edition, together with a supplement from the hand of Baumgartner, which contained a German Hebrew and a German Aramaic glossary, together with a list of corrections and additions to the first edition, and some other information. The first volume of the third edition to this impressive dictionary appeared in 1967. Unfortunately, however, in this edition, the approach of using bilingual glosses was abandoned. The need arose, therefore, for a separate English edition, of which the first volume appeared in 1993. The last volume of the Hebrew part of this dictionary was published in July 1999. Unlike BDB, this dictionary is not based on the one by Gesenius. Since Kuller and Baumgartner's work is of a much more recent date than the dictionaries that were mentioned earlier, it can be considered much more up-to-date. As far as its organization is concerned, however, this dictionary is not significantly different from the one by Gesenius. It differs from BDB in that all entries have been listed alphabetically, with the result that it is easier to find a particular entry in this dictionary. For each root, all words that are considered to have been derived from it are listed, so that the user is still able to see the etymological relations between the root and its derivatives. One of the ways in which this dictionary, henceforth referred to as KB, differs from the ones that were mentioned earlier lies in the fact that it is based on a Hebrew text that, according to the preface of the edition in 1958, is free from obvious scribal errors and other mistakes. In other words, KB contains quite a number of conjectural emendations, even though this same preface claims that the greatest reserve was shown in the matter of emendation of the traditional text. According to the introduction to the first volume of the third edition, which appeared in 1967, however, many of the proposals for textual change in the first edition were abandoned in the third edition. In spite of this, however, KB still contains a considerable number of textual emendations, even though text-critical insights regarding the Hebrew text of the Old Testament have changed considerably in the course of the last decades. Only a cursory glance at the results of the Hebrew Old Testament Text Project will make this abundantly clear. KB is a useful dictionary that provides the user with a large quantity of valuable information. From a lexicographical point of view, however, this dictionary does not have much more to offer than BDB. Now for the Dictionary of Classical Hebrew, edited by David J. A. Kleins, which first came out in 1993. One of the ways in which it is said to differ from other Hebrew dictionaries is that it designates and defines a phase of the language as classical Hebrew. This dictionary is said to cover all Hebrew texts from the period prior to about 200 CE. In addition to the Hebrew Old Testament, it covers the following texts as well. Number 1, Ben Sira. Number two, Qumran manuscripts and related texts. And number three, inscriptions and other occasional texts. In addition, this dictionary is said to differ from other dictionaries in that it is based on modern linguistic principles. According to the introduction, the focus in this dictionary is not so much on the meanings or the translation equivalents of individual words as on the patterns and combinations in which words are used. And attention is paid primarily not to the unusual and difficult words, but to the common words. As far as its organization is concerned, this dictionary has followed the same method as Gassanius and BDB. All words have been listed alphabetically. It also provides the user with the number of occurrences of each lemma in the four different bodies of text that were listed above. This information is followed by the part of speech and a gloss that helps the user identify the lemma. Then all morphological forms of the lemma are listed, followed by its semantic analysis, its syntagmatic analysis, depending on its part of speech, and its paradigmatic analysis, such as synonyms, antonyms, etc. Finally, a number of related entries is given. Klein's dictionary, henceforth referred to as DCH, does not contain any comparative data from other Semitic languages either, because the significance of the cognates has been systematically misunderstood by many users of the traditional dictionaries. Another important feature of this dictionary is that it makes an effort to keep semantic, syntagmatic, and paradigmatic information apart. It is a well-organized dictionary that contains a treasure of information. It also deserves praise for the fact that, in most cases, all references in which a particular word occurs have been listed. The wide range of texts that are covered is unprecedented as well. DCH also seems to be considerably more reluctant to suggest emendations of the Hebrew text than KB. There is no doubt, therefore, that this dictionary is an important step forward in the history of Hebrew lexicography. It has a number of disadvantages as well, however. Unfortunately, a structural semantic analysis of classical Hebrew is missing. Therefore, the semantic analysis for each particular entry has a large subjective element in it. On this same page, the author of the introduction even states that our perception of senses is often dependent on the semantic structure of the English language. That is how it must be and should be, of course, in an interlingual dictionary. End quote. Muraoka labels this correctly as, quote, a most extraordinary and dogmatic statement, end quote. This statement may hold some truth for a Bible translator who wants to translate the Old Testament into English, but it is hard to accept for someone who wants to do translation work in any other language and needs a dictionary in the English language in order to understand what the Hebrew text says. A Hebrew dictionary is to teach us something about meaning in Hebrew, and too much emphasis on the semantic structure of the English language may prevent us from really understanding what goes on in Hebrew. Only a structural semantic analysis of Hebrew can help us to understand what the language is trying to communicate, and only on the basis of such an analysis will we be able to determine which semantic domains are relevant to the language. Therefore, in spite of what the introduction says, the makers of DCH have not used the insights provided by modern lexicography to the fullest extent. Another problem, though somehow related to the one described in the previous paragraph, lies in the fact that the meaning of each individual subentry is described in the form of one or more glosses rather than a clear definition. This makes it much more difficult to get a clear overview of the different senses that one particular entry may have. As a result of this dictionary looks more like other dictionaries than would have been necessary. A further disadvantage, as Derecht observes, is that the senses of a word are generally arranged in order of frequency of attestation. However interesting the information that is gained by this perspective may be, it is not of a semantic nature and prevents us from getting a clear view of the different senses of an entry and the way these senses relate to each other. Finally, one could ask oneself the question whether DCH does not contain an overload of information. Is it really necessary to list all different verbs that have the word av, father, as subject, all verbs that have it as object, and all types of nominal clauses in which it occurs? Do we not have computer programs these days that can provide us with information of that nature if we really want it? What are the semantic benefits of knowing all passages where Moses is the subject of ahaz, to hold or seize or grasp, rather than Jacob or David? A dictionary should not be an exhaustive encyclopedia containing all information available about a particular word, but should limit itself to the information that is relevant from a semantic point of view. Now, 1 year after the first volume of DCH saw the light, another remarkable dictionary was published. Luis Alonso Schockel, in cooperation with Victor Morla and Vicente Collado, published their Diccionario Bíblico Hebreo Español, which will henceforth be referred to as DBHE. This dictionary is organized alphabetically, like Gesenius, KB, and DCH, and has a lot of features in common with DCH. Like DCH, it is well organized and does not contain etymological or comparative data. DBHE does not contain the same amount of information as DCH, although that may well be an advantage rather than a disadvantage, as not all information in DCH is relevant. DBHE can be considered a modern dictionary that has really made an effort to incorporate modern lexicographical insights. Many entries, for instance, though unfortunately not all, are explained by means of descriptive phrases instead of a series of glosses. And what is even more important, the makers of this dictionary have even made use of a kind of semantic domains to distinguish between different ways certain words are used. The entry for Evan, stone, for instance, is divided into 9 sub-entries on the basis of semantic categories like natural substance, construction material, weapons, ornamental use, commercial use, religious and cultural use, pagan use, meteorological use, and figurative use. This is very helpful. Unfortunately, however, this dictionary has a number of disadvantages as well. Unlike DCH, DBHE does not list the number of occurrences of each entry, and it does not list the scripture references for almost all entries either. In addition to that, semantic domains are only used in the case of entries that can be considered key terms or technical terms. When it comes to less frequent or less important words, DBHE resembles the more traditional dictionaries. Moreover, a structural semantic analysis of Hebrew seems to be missing. The way this dictionary is organized also does not allow the user to compare different sub-entries that belong to one single semantic domain. An index organized according to semantic domains could be very helpful here, although its significance would be limited as not all entries have a semantic classification. In spite of this, however, DBHE is a commendable dictionary and an important step ahead of what has been published so far in this field, including DCH. Towards the end of the 1980s, a totally new lexicographic product saw the light when Johannes P. Lau and Eugene A. Nida, with the help of Rondell B. Smith and Karen Munson, published their Greek-English Lexicon of the New Testament based on semantic domains. This lexicon was based on the latest insights in modern semantic analysis, and as a result of that, was organized in a way that differed drastically from what had been done so far. This lexicon will henceforth be referred to as LN. The user who expects an alphabetic list of Greek words finds a list of 93 semantic domains instead, ranging from geographical objects and features to names of persons and places. Most semantic domains contain a number of subdomains. Even at that level, words have not been arrayed alphabetically. Instead of that, words with generic meanings are listed before words with more specific meanings. In order to be able to find a particular word, an index has been added that lists each entry alphabetically and leads the users to the various semantic subdomains or domains where this word can be found. In a number of cases, footnotes have been used to explain why certain entries or groups of entries were classified under one domain rather than another, or why the editors felt it necessary to set up certain domains for entries that could have been classified under another domain as well. The first distinction in the classification of words that Lau and Nida have made is threefold. 1. Unique reference, words that refer to one single unique object, proper names. 2. Class reference, words that refer to a class of objects, events, or attributes, or common words. 3. Markers, words that mark the relationship between other words, like objects, events, or attributes. Another term that is often used in semantics and which seems to denote the same category of words is relationals. On the first page of the introduction to their lexicon, Lau and Nida report to have devoted their domains 1 through 12 to objects. According to them, domains 13 through 57 are used to designate events, and domains 58 through 91 are said to contain attributes, including relationals. As we just observed, this information is a little contradictory, as earlier on the same page, they claim domains 89 and 91 to contain markers, which are to be considered different from class reference. So how can Lau and Nida group attributes and relationals together? We get the impression that Lau and Nida are referring to two different models at the same time, and that is confusing. It may be better to cling to the simpler division of lexical units into objects, events, attributes, and relationals. Could we conclude on the basis of Lau and Nida's introduction that domains 58 through 88 contain attributes, whereas domains 89 through 91 contain relationals? We cannot say that with certainty. Also, the position of 92, discourse referentials, within this framework does not become entirely clear. Are they to be considered relationals according to their approach? Maybe. In this research, we will not make use of Lau and Nida's categories, unique reference, class reference, and markers. Instead of that, we will use the simpler division of all lexical units into the four categories of objects, events, attributes, and relationals. The basis on which Lau and Nida have set up the entire range of semantic domains that they have used are what they call the three major classes of semantic features: shared, distinctive, and supplementary. Shared features are those semantic features that certain lexical elements have in common. In addition to that, each lexical item has distinctive features that distinguishes it from other lexical items. Finally, most lexical items have a number of supplementary features as well that are of a more peripheral nature and play a role in a limited number of contexts. Now, Lau and Nida's dictionary is a very helpful tool for the study of New Testament Greek. But what to do with Biblical Hebrew? The scholarly world is desperately in need of a dictionary of this language that is built on the same principles. It actually is a pity that this needs to be done after the completion of this New Testament dictionary. It is an undeniable fact that the Old Testament has had a major influence on the New Testament. It would not be an overstatement to say that it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to understand the New Testament well without a thorough understanding of the Old. Much of the terminology that is used in the New Testament has its origin in the Old Testament, and that has consequences for our semantic analysis of those terms. While studying Lau and Nida's lexicon and going through the different semantic domains, it is not always easy to resist the impression that the semantic framework that was used is based on a mixture of two distinct types of information. An example may illustrate this. Let us look, for instance, at their domain, attachment. Entry 18.4 is the verb harpazo, which is defined as to grab or seize by force with the purpose of removing and or controlling. This same verb can be found under possess, transfer, exchange category number 57. Entry 57.235, where this verb is said to mean to forcefully take something away from somebody else, often with the implication of a sudden attack. Another occurrence of this same verb in 37.28 can be found under control or rule, category 37, where it has been defined as to gain control over by force. Now, if we compare these three definitions carefully, we will see that they have quite a lot in common. These three entries share a considerable number of semantic features, although there are a number of distinctive and supplementary features that play an important role as well. But if we look at the shared semantic features of these three instances of harpazo, it gives us some important lexical information about this verb. Unfortunately, the way this dictionary has been organized makes it difficult to obtain this information. On the basis of the three definitions given above, one could easily give a basic definition of the meaning of harpazo. This would be something like to forcefully take hold of an object. Every context in which the verb occurs, however, draws our attention to other components of meaning, either of a distinctive or supplementary nature, that help us determine the exact meaning of harpazo in that particular context. One glance at Lao and Nida's Greek-English index provides us with numerous other examples. The distinction between generic and specific that Lao and Nida often use does not help us very much here. Why would entry 18.4 be more generic than 37 or 57? All three passages that contain this verb, harpazo, have a context that helps us determine the exact meaning of this verb within that context. Lao makes an important distinction between what he calls the lexical and the contextual meaning of words. The former deals with those aspects of meaning that a word contributes in and of itself, whereas the latter deals with the information provided by the utterance in which that word occurs, involving the circumstances of and the objects referred to in a specific context in terms of its usage in such a context, along with other words or phrases contributing to the context. A distinction like this, though we have to formulate it a little bit more precisely, would help us deal effectively with a word like harpazo. It would be very rewarding if we could make a distinction between the lexical meaning of this word and its contextual meaning. The former would deal with the meaning of the word in its minimal context, whereas the latter would deal with its meaning in its wider context. The lexical meaning of a word would focus on the shared semantic features of all occurrences of that word, whereas its contextual meaning would take all its semantic features into consideration. The Hebrew Old Testament contains more than one literary genre. A substantial part of it is written in poetry, and one of the features of Hebrew poetry, as in so many other languages, is the figurative use of language. But also, in non-poetic texts, we can find an impressive amount of figurative language. Certain metaphors and other figures of speech are so common in biblical Hebrew that it becomes hard to see them as highly marked, specialized expressions. They seem to have become a structural part of the language. Let us take a word like cherev, for example. Literally, this word means sword, and according to Lao and Nida's classification, would belong to category number 6, artifacts. But if we go through all occurrences of this word in the Old Testament, we will discover that it is often used in a metaphorical sense, with focus on the activity that a sword is most commonly used for, violence, aggression, or war. Now, if it were easy to indicate in which context cherev refers to sword as an artifact and in which context it denotes violence, aggression, or war, we would not have a problem. Cherev A would be classified under artifacts and cherev B under violence, harm, destroy, kill. But this is exactly where the problem lies. In a considerable number of passages, it is not easy to choose between these two possibilities. Let us take the RSV translation of Jeremiah 47, 6 and 7 as an example. Ah, sword of the Lord, how long till you are quiet? Put yourself in your scabbard, rest and be still. How can it be quiet when the Lord has given it a charge? Against Ashkelon and against the seashore he has appointed it. This is just one of several cases in which sword is used in more than a single sense. Is it used as an artifact here? Yes, because of the scabbard. Is it used as an event here? Sure, because it actually means war in this context. This is a case where the way Lao and Nida have organized their lexicon becomes problematic for biblical Hebrew. And this is not just an isolated example. It actually is a structural problem in this language. Many words that basically denote a particular object are also used to refer to the type of activity that the object is normally used for. In addition to that, there are words in Hebrew that technically should be considered events, but that in certain contexts are used to denote the most prominent object in the argument structure of that event. Because of these patterns, however, Lao and Nida's methodology of organizing words by semantic domains rather than in their alphabetical order may not work well for biblical Hebrew because it does not give us sufficient insight into the different ways one single word can be used. And that is exactly what is so important if we want to have an idea of what is happening in Hebrew semantics. If we miss the patterns, we will miss the essentials. Even the presence of an index, as is contained in Volume 2, of Lao and Nida's lexicon, does not sufficiently bridge the gap. The question that arises then is the following. Is there a way to modify Lao and Nida's framework in such a way that it will overcome its weaknesses, at least from the perspective of biblical Hebrew, and will be able to serve as a sound basis for a new lexicon? The answer to that question is yes, and it is the aim of this research to come up with a modified framework that will do full justice to a language like Biblical Hebrew and its underlying culture and worldview, without discarding the important insights with which Lau and Nida's work have provided us. A number of major modifications will have to be introduced, however, which will be discussed in the following subsections. Lexical versus contextual domains. We have already mentioned the distinction between lexical and contextual meaning. A lexical entry has one or more lexical meanings that focus on the components of meaning that are shared by a group of obviously related instances of that lexical entry. In addition to that, for each lexical meaning, there are one or more contextual meanings that take all relevant aspects of the context of a particular instance of this entry into consideration. In order to make that possible, we will need to make a distinction between lexical and contextual semantic domains. This implies that most lexical entries have to be classified twice and receive both lexical and contextual labels. In other words, every entry or subentry may have one or more lexical meanings and will therefore be assigned to one or more lexical semantic domains. For each lexical meaning, in turn, we may find one or more different contexts, each providing its own relevant information that will need to be converted by one or more contextual semantic domains. Lexical entries like soldier and carpenter, for example, both have one lexical meaning. From a lexical point of view, both could be covered by one single lexical domain labeled people. From a contextual perspective, however, the former would need to be assigned to a contextual domain like warfare, whereas the latter would fit well under the contextual domain crafts. Words like sword and chisel could be dealt with in a similar way. Lexically, both are objects, artifacts, according to Lau and Nida's classification. But from a more contextual point of view, they would be classified under the same domains as the two words discussed in the previous paragraph. In order to illustrate this further, let us look at the word hevel, rope, which lexically and according to LN's list of domains, should be classified under artifacts. This word, however, is used in many different contexts, as we can see in the examples below. A, as an instrument for measuring, then we have 2 Samuel 8:2. B, as an instrument for hunting, Job 18:10. C, as an object that helps to keep a tent in its place, Isaiah 33:20. D, as a part of the rigging of a ship, Isaiah 33:23. E, as a sign of submission, 1 Kings 20:31. This verse says, "Let us put sackcloth on our loins and ropes upon our heads." Now, in whatever context hevel occurs, it remains an artifact. Lexically, nothing changes. Contextually, however, there is a lot of variation. It should be noted, however, that one single entry may have more than one lexical meaning. The verb hava, for instance, has six lexical meanings, which will be listed below in the form of definitions. A, to go to a location where one will not be readily seen by others and or be safe from danger. B, location where one will be safe from danger. C, causative of A, to cause someone else to go to a location where that person will not be readily seen by others and or be safe from danger. D, to leave in a way that other people do not notice. E, as C, but without indication of a specific location, to keep someone from physical or non-physical harm. F, as A, but extended to events, to come to a stop. For each of these six lexical meanings, however, we can find several different contexts, each of which provides information that can be relevant to the text and that needs to be covered by one or more contextual domains. Now, if we incorporate this contextual information in the form of glosses into the little scheme above, we will get something like this. A, to go to a location where one will not be readily seen by others and or be safe from danger, and then subpoints. To hide oneself out of fear of a supernatural being, to hide oneself out of fear of an aggressor, to hide oneself out of shame or shyness during a public gathering, to withdraw, step aside out of respect for someone important during a public gathering, and to hide oneself, ambush, in order to attack someone. And then he goes on to do the same with the rest of the definitions. Now, the paper goes on, and I would encourage you to go look at it, because a lot of these things are best seen with your eyes rather than listened to. Definitely check it out. I really want to honor the work of this man who has put in so many years to help the study of Hebrew, to help the work of Bible translation advance in this way. Next time, the next episode, we're going to get to talk to him and hear him address some things that he didn't really talk about in this paper, and hear a little bit more about his journey over the last couple decades working on this lexicon, things he's learned since he wrote this paper back in 2000, etc. Anyway, thank you so much for listening, and I hope this has been illuminating, helpful, interesting, and we'll catch you in the next episode.